Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Welcome to the latest Oxford Institute for Energy Studies podcast. My name is David Ledesma, and I'm chairman of the Natural Gas Programme at the Institute. And it's my great pleasure to be joined today by Bassam Fatou, who is director of the OIS. And we're here today to discuss the key messages that have come from the recent and indeed previous oil monthlies that are being published by the Institute each month. Now, just to timestamp this podcast, we are recording it on the morning of Friday, the 7th of May, 2021. Welcome, Bassam, to the OIS podcast series.
Thank you, David, for having me.
Now, before we dive into our discussion, could you say a couple of things about the OIS Oil Monthly? You know, why did the Institute launch it? How is it structured? And what gap is it expected to fill?
The OIS Oil Monthly is a new publication which we launched at the Institute in February of this year. It features a comprehensive analysis on global oil market dynamics, oil policy, geopolitics, price risks, stock and flows, as well as detailed short-term forecast 2 years ahead. The Oil Monthly draws from the vast experience of the OIS Oil Program Research Group and also on the advanced quantitative and qualitative research conducted at the Institute. The report also features a dedicated think piece every month, focusing on a timely issue shaping the global oil market. We recognize that there are a lot of outlooks out there, but the methodologies behind many of these outlooks are not known, and transparency is often lacking. Our analysis is based on advanced and rigorous empirical oil market models, with the principal model underlying the research being a state-of-the-art structural VAR model of the global oil market. This is then integrated with oil supply and demand forecasting models, which are further decomposed by regions, sectors, and fuels. Well, we hope that through this publication, we are able to share our views on key issues impacting the oil market, provide useful information in a very accessible way, and also present our forecast in a transparent manner based on a robust empirical framework.
Yeah, I must admit, Bassam, I found the April one, which we're about to discuss, absolutely fascinating, because you're discussing, you know, the impact of US shale on the fact it will remain a key factor shaping market outcomes, and also the impact of recovery of demand from COVID. So really a fascinating read. So why don't we talk about the April issue now? Because you do highlight two distinguishing features of the COVID cycle, one on the demand side and one on the supply. So why don't we start with the one on the demand side? Perhaps you could kind of share with our listeners some of the messages.
Every oil cycle has some special features. And the COVID-19 cycle, as I call it, is no different. And to me, two particular features stand out. One on the demand side and one on the supply side. And of course, the two do interact. On the demand side, in addition to the size of the COVID shock, which is unprecedented in the history of the oil market, its impact was uneven on global oil demand. And this evenness was reflected across geographies, across fuels, but also across economic activities, where the tourism retail sector was badly hit, especially compared to the goods sector. This unevenness is now being reflected in the current recovery, which is highly unsynchronized. For instance, China has witnessed relatively strong recovery and has been doing quite well. The recovery in the US has been quite choppy, but the recent data have been very encouraging as the rollout of the vaccine has been successful. In contrast, Europe recovery is still lagging, but prospects have been improving as the vaccine rollout gathers momentum. In India, the recovery has taken a setback with the recent rise in virus cases, and India's oil demand is expected to take a big hit in April and May. And this weakness could extend to the rest of the year if the spread of the virus is not controlled quickly. Also, the recovery in oil demand is highly unsynchronized across fuels with massive impact on refining sector. Refining margins remain weak despite cuts in runs. And although there is optimism towards the second half of this year, as refineries ramp up production, the pressure on refining margins will persist. We see gasoline cracks have improved in April, supported by an uptick in Europe and the US, but gas oil margins remain well below their normal averages. Jet fuel has been hit the most, but recovering slowly on the back of local travel in places such as China and the US, and the EU announcement to allow fully vaccinated tourists to travel in the summer. So overall, a very uneven picture, and this I consider to be a special feature of this cycle.
Yeah, I have to say, I think your expression that the recovery is highly unsynchronized really brings it home, doesn't it, Bassam? I must admit. But now, why do we step back to the March issue of the OIS Monthly when you devoted the kind of the in focus piece to China demand dynamics? Now, what are the key trends in terms of crude products, refining runs and storage within China that the oil market should look out for in the rest of the year in 2021? And I expect the question that everybody would like to know the answer to is, could China still lead the world on demand? What do you think of that, Bassam?
Well, China was in 2020 and remains in 2021 a key consumer of crude. But as we highlighted in that piece, 2020 was very much about stockpiling, while 2021, crude flows are driven by strong refinery runs. We expect refinery runs to remain the driver of imports because of strong end product demand as the recovery continues. And also because there's at least 700,000 barrels per day of new refining capacity starting this year. It's true that there is some stockpiling taking place, but there is less urgency to fill tanks this year because a lot was done last year. And of course, prices are higher now. Now, in terms of product demand, economic activity remains strong and product demand is rising. We are seeing industrial activity picking up and demand for transport fuel is robust, although travel during the Chinese New Year was limited because of a second wave of infections. But it's industrial fuels that have really been driving the recovery, certainly more than jet, but gasoline use ahead of the summer is also likely to increase. Having said that, China still has a structural surplus of products, so exports are probably going to increase this year. And this trend will continue longer term. The government did pledge to peak emissions by 2030, and environmental regulations around refining and chemicals may tighten, but China continues to add greenfield refining capacity. And as demand growth slows in the next few years, exports will continue to rise.
Interesting. Well, look, why don't we talk, perhaps take our conversation for the next few minutes across to supply. You know, what are the distinguishing features on the supply side? And I obviously guess this must be related to OPEC Plus. What are your views?
Yes, that's correct, David. The second feature of this COVID-19 cycle really has been the effectiveness of the OPEC Plus response. And this has been reflected in a number of ways. The high compliance of OPEC Plus, despite the historical size of the agreed cut, and despite excluding from the agreement countries suffering from output disruptions, namely Libya, Iran, and Venezuela. The length of the agreement, which extended into April 2022, provided a stable framework for OPEC Plus. Also, the ability of producers to reach compromises on output decisions and maintain their cohesion within the group. Against most expectations, the relationship between Saudi Arabia and Russia continued to strengthen following the breakup of the OPEC Plus agreement in March 2020. And this challenged the notion that OPEC Plus can only manage the market on the downside. The holding of the joint ministerial monitoring committee meetings on a monthly basis to monitor the compliance of participating countries also contributed to the high compliance. I would also add the introduction of a new compensation mechanism for countries to make up for past overproduction, which acted as a tool to put pressure to achieve better compliance. But perhaps more important is that OPEC Plus has shown proactiveness and flexibility by adjusting output policy almost on a monthly basis to respond to the increased short-term uncertainty. Another feature, I would say, has been the willingness of Saudi Arabia to act independently and to take additional measures beyond the OPEC Plus agreement by making substantial additional unilateral cuts. A final feature is the ability of the OPEC Plus, particularly Saudi Arabia, to continue to surprise the market with key decisions. For instance, those related to implementing extra voluntary cuts, rolling over production cuts, and raising supplies in a more gradual manner to meet the expected increase in demand. Creating this sense of uncertainty about OPEC Plus decisions has been an effective tool for reducing open interest, as the risk of being on the wrong side of an OPEC Plus decision has increased. All these factors, at least to me, point to a more flexible and more effective OPEC Plus in dealing with the adverse shock of COVID-19 and in influencing market expectations and shaping sentiment.
But from what you say, it sounds like, you know, Saudi Arabia is acting increasingly independently. And does this not imply that the kingdom is now effectively becoming a swing producer, a role that it said it would not play?
I don't think so. There is no doubt that Saudi Arabia has been doing more than its fair share with the voluntary cuts. But this do not elevate for the swing producer role, and for a number of reasons. First, the voluntary cuts have been limited in duration. Second, for a swing producer to be effective, it needs to swing all the time in response to changing market conditions. It needs to swing in all directions, and it needs to send a credible signal to the market that it's willing to play this role under all market circumstances. Saudi Arabia has not sent such a signal, and on the contrary, have said repeatedly that they will not play this role. And if the payoffs change, they could shift policy. I would argue that the voluntary cut had a positive impact because other OPEC Plus maintained high compliance. So the latest move by Saudi Arabia should be seen within the OPEC Plus context dynamics. It is one way to encourage compliance. Other countries did not want to risk the breakup of the OPEC Plus agreement by producing above their quotas when Saudi Arabia was cutting, and this in part could explain the high compliance in Q1 of this year. Through this move, Saudi Arabia slowed the return of barrels into the market in what turned out to be a very weak Q1. Also, Saudi Arabia widened its option. But even in terms of foregone revenues, we did some estimations which show that Saudi Arabia ended up achieving higher revenues than compared to a scenario in which OPEC Plus would have increased supplies in Q1 and risk a stock build and a fall in the oil price.
But if you look out, say, for the next couple of years, you know, do you still see OPEC Plus remaining in the driving seat?
Yes, I think so. OPEC Plus will remain in the driving seat at least for the rest of this year, for a number of reasons. First, the buffer in the form of commercial stocks, particularly outside China, will erode further as the market deficits in the second half of 2021 are expected to widen. Also, the buffer in form of spare capacity is likely to be lower than consensus estimates, which suggests a cushion of 8 to 9 million barrels per day. Some of the OPEC Plus countries, such as Algeria, Angola, and Nigeria, may not be in a position to restore production to their base levels agreed by OPEC Plus back in April 2020. The shock has hit investment and activity in their oil sector quite badly. Also, as OPEC Plus members start increasing their production and approaching their maximum capacity, compliance will improve, and we will see some of the countries starting to involuntarily compensate for their overproduction. Non-OPEC supply will respond to higher oil prices, but the responses will be limited in 2021 before gradually increasing in 2022 due to the lags between investment and production. These lead times could be longer due to greater scrutiny from investors and the lack of enthusiasm for financing oil projects, especially projects with long investment cycles.
So I expect an interesting question would be therefore to ask, you know, what could disturb these dynamics within OPEC Plus? Because it sounds like it's working.
Well, two factors are often mentioned, Iran and US shale. Let me start with Iran. you know, first, the timetable for the return of Iranian barrels remain highly uncertain. I think both countries want to reach an agreement, but the U.S. and Iran's positions are still far apart, and it will take time to iron the technical issues. So finalizing the agreement can take time and could extend to 2022. In the absence of a deal, Iran's export can rise very much from here, as so far it's only China's refineries that have shown willingness to pick up Iranian crude. But even with the revival of Iran's nuclear deal, the increase could be more moderate. Iranian exports of crude and condensates have already risen, which could imply that the increase from here would be more moderate, around 1 to 1.2 million barrels per day. And if demand recovers, as many are expecting, this could be absorbed into the market. Now, within OPEC Plus, only when Iran reaches its October 2018 levels, there will be discussion on how to bring Iran back into the OPEC Plus agreement. So I don't see these Iranian leakages disrupting the OPEC Plus dynamics, at least not for now.
Interesting. Now, as I mentioned earlier on, like a focus area of the April OISR monthly is US shale. So why don't we talk about that for a few minutes, Bassam? You know, could US shale, you know, act as a disruptive factor like it has in previous cycles?
Well, it depends very much on the horizon, David. Unlike the 2014-2016 cycle, U.S. shale response to the COVID-19 shock was sharp and fast. Between March and May 2020, output declined by around 2.4 million barrels per day. Now, as prices started recovering in May 2020, shut-in wells were brought back into production and output recovered. But as of March 2021, it's still below its pre-shock level of 9.1 million barrels per day. More importantly, there has been a shift in perceptions about U.S. shale behavior. There's a wide belief that U.S. shale producers have endorsed the principle of capital discipline. And despite the rise in oil price and the better prospects, the improved cash flows have been used to reduce debt and return money to shareholders. The view of capital discipline is supported by CapEx guidance of the U.S. shale sectors, where CapEx budgets are expected to increase only marginally in 2021. Many majors and independents expect production to remain flat or increase marginally from 2020 levels. So for 2021, U.S. shale may not prove disruptive for oil markets and OPEC Plus. In our latest monthly, published earlier this week, we estimate U.S. shale output on annual terms to contract by almost 400,000 barrels per day. And for 2020 as a whole, U.S. shale output will average around 1 million barrels per day below 2019 levels.
And that I have to say, will certainly have an implication. But why don't we talk about U.S. shale performance in 2022? Could it surprise on the upside, do you think?
Well, yes, 2022 could be a different story. Although there's a moderate increase in break-even cost, they're still below the current oil prices. Also, at current oil prices, some operators could repair their balance sheet and push for higher output. It's also important to recognize that operator strategies are diverse. Majors, public listed companies, and private producers have different strategies and respond to different incentives. Private operators are not under the same pressure as publicly listed companies, and they are a force to reckon with as they hold more than half of the horizontal rig count. Private operators are already leading the recovery, increasing their activity and adding rigs and completing wells. Some of them may ramp activity in the expectation to sell and exit. So in our latest monthly, for 2020 as a whole, U.S. shale production is seen growing year on year by around 950,000 barrels per day. But the range of uncertainty around our estimate is wide. On the downside, lower productivity gains and capital constraint could limit year-on-year growth to around 400,000 barrels per day. On the upside, higher productivity gains and increases in capital spending could boost year-on-year growth to 1.2 million barrels per day. So the range of uncertainty is much higher, but regardless of the scenarios, U.S. shale production will not reach its peak level in 2019.
Well, look, Bassam, we're kind of getting towards the end of the podcast, but why don't we spend a few minutes talking about kind of oil prices? Because OPEC always emphasizes that it doesn't have an explicit price target, but they seem to want to support the prices above $60. So, and also they're willing to give up market share to support that price. So I wondered what your views were on this.
Well, the focus of OPEC Plus is on inventories and bringing them down to the 2015-2019 five-year average and maintaining the backwardation in the market. Oil exporters tend and should focus on revenues, which does not depend only on price, but price multiplied by quantity. Now, in the face of a negative shock such as COVID-19, the easiest way to balance the market is for OPEC Plus to cut output. If cutting output in cooperation with other producers achieve higher revenues, then the alternative of putting additional barrels in an oversupplied market, then the market share becomes less of an issue, at least in the short term. But there will be circumstances in which a producer may decide to pursue market share. For instance, if it hasn't been possible to reach a collective agreement, or if after reaching an agreement the compliance is weak, so the costs from restricting output outweigh the benefits, in which case market share matters. So what I'm trying to say, it's not black and white, and it depends on market circumstances, the cohesion within the group, how supply outside the group will respond. This is not to say that the producers don't care about the price level. They do. They don't want prices to be too low to harm their economies and undermine investment in the sector, but also not too high to encourage new sources of supply and weaken demand. But to me, price stability within a reasonable range matters more given their highly undiversified economies. The challenge has always been to achieve price stability, but as current events show, this has been elusive. In my view, this idea that there's a price out there that OPEC Plus or Saudi Arabia is willing to defend at whatever cost and regardless of the circumstances, and that players such as US shale and their private backers have an OPEC Plus guarantee is quite simplistic. Shifts in policy do occur.
Well, can we perhaps then, Bassam, can end the podcast kind of with a longer term perspective, because there's been some talk about an oil super cycle, which could see sustained rises in oil prices. And I wondered, you know, what your views were on this.
Well, in the April issue, we ran over 30 scenarios from bullish to bearish, and none of these scenarios hit anywhere close to $100 per barrel. Instead, we get a range of annual average price between $60 to $70 per barrel for the rest of 2021 and 2022, with monthly prices bounded between $55 per barrel and $75 per barrel. Of course, this does not mean that monthly prices will not exceed those bounds in the next few months. Sentiment could push prices beyond these boundaries, but they are not likely to be sustainable. As to the super cycle, it depends on the definition. If it is a sustained rise in oil prices for a prolonged period, 3-5 years, I don't see it, at least not yet. Some key triggers of an oil super cycle, such as an elastic supply in the face of rampant demand and lack of spare capacity and refining constraints, are still missing. Demand growth remains highly uncertain, both in the short term and medium term. There's plenty of spare capacity, and this could be made available to the market in short notice. OECD stocks have been declining, but China's stocks remain high, though we don't see China using strategic reserve as a mechanism to put a cap on the oil price, though if prices rise, some of the stocks will be utilized and purchasing for stock building will slow. Also, it depends on the baseline against which you measure the stock level. If the average OECD stock over the 2000 2019 is the base, then this is almost achieved. If 2010-2014 averages use, then OECD stock remain elevated. Also, David, as discussed earlier, the supply curve has become more elastic over time, in part due to U.S. shale. And finally, there are no refining constraints like in the previous super cycle. In fact, it's the opposite. Rationalization of refining capacity needs to happen in the next few years to keep runs high.
Well, thank you, Bassam, so much for a fascinating discussion and also for your time. You know, as always, I really enjoyed our conversation. It kind of builds on the recent All Monthly publications that can all be found on the OIES website. I hope you've all enjoyed listening to this podcast. Thank you and goodbye to everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as all our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our oil, gas, electricity or China programmes, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.